Good afternoon. Welcome to Tate Modern. I'm Gabriela Salgado, Curator of Public Programs. And I'm glad to introduce this afternoon's event, which is part of our wonderful series in collaboration with Art Monthly, which have been running for two seasons now and are coming to an end in June with the last event of this this season with Susan Hiller on the 14th of June. After that, we will start again in the autumn, and we will have once a month a conversation between an artist and a theorist, writer, critic who is somehow related to Art Monthly. This event is, as I said, a collaboration with Art Monthly, and next to me is Patricia Vickers, the editor of Art Monthly, who will introduce the speakers today. The plan for the afternoon is that the conversation between Lisa Lefebvre and Cornelia Parker will take place first, and then we'll open for questions from the floor. We'd need to wait for microphones, so please, when you want to ask questions, just raise your hand and wait for the microphone, because we are recording this event and it will be online on the website, on Tate website. Just a reminder before I pass it on to Patricia, and this is that Cornelia's 30 Pieces of Silver installation is on show at the moment at Tate Modern, and I recommend if you haven't seen it that you go to Level 3 Poetry and Dream display. Among the collection displays on is in room 10. So I hope you enjoy the event, and please help me welcome Patricia Vickers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you to Gabriela and to the Tate. This has been a most fruitful collaboration. We've enjoyed it, and I hope you have. Well, where can I begin with Cornelia Parker? We're very proud that she's agreed to join this series. I'm sure most of you will remember she burst onto the scene literally with Cold Dark Matter, An Exploded View, which was the garden shed piece, exploded and then suspended in Chisenhale Gallery. But in fact, I'd been familiar with her work long before that and excited by it. Of course, there was Colder, Darker Matter as well that was shown in the Tate when she was shortlisted for the Turner Prize, Colder, Darker Matter Mass, which was the charred pieces of a church burnt down, a black church burned down in Texas. Is that right?
A white church. Been struck by lightning,
excuse me.
A later book.
Yes, and there's a third version.
There was a diptych for it.
Right. And she's recently had a show at the Icon, which is touring as museums in the world fighting to have the show, which some of you may have seen at the Icon. And, of course, she has a permanent work on display in the V&A, which is called Breathless, which is suspended from the ceiling. So do search that out, and of course 30 Pieces of Silver. But Cornelia's been working in so many different media, and she also has a project which Lisa may even be able to help her realize, which is a long-term project, to return a meteor to its source, to shoot it into the stratosphere. Anyway, we're very proud to have her here, and very grateful to Lisa Lefebvre, who is curator at the National Maritime Museum, and she teaches at Goldsmiths, and thankfully writes for us in whatever her spare time may be. And I'm sure you will enjoy the conversation they're going to have. I know I will. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Patricia, and thank you, Gabriela. It's a very strange thing to be sitting here next to Cornelia, because, of course, there's so many things that I want to ask her. I want to say, tell me about this piece of work and tell me about that piece of work. But I want to try and start off by avoiding my intense curiosity and just kind of think a little bit about the ways that we come across your work. And it seems that throughout all of your practice, Cornelia, you've done so many interviews and conversations, and there's just countless wonderful exchanges to read where you're talking through so many of your works. And it seems to me that there seems to be such an importance with your work, not just on the what of it, so not just on the experience of what we see, but also in terms of the how of it. So the questions, well, how did this piece of work get made? How did this other piece of work get made? And I wanted to really ask you a little bit about the importance of the conversations that happen around your work, which seem even more apparent with the piece of work, Chomsky in Abstract, that you might have seen at the Whitechapel Gallery just a few months ago.
Yes, I suppose conversations are very important to me. I realised, I mean, because in 89 I went and did a residency in Rome, a 3-month Rome scholarship, and I realised for the first time that my work's quite oral. The way I go about making work is very much to do with conversations, not with people from the art world necessarily, but with people I help, who I collaborate with, or people like the British Army, or you know, the Customs and Excise, whoever I've worked with in the past. And I realised when I was in Italy, because I didn't speak Italian, I realised lot of making work that was really hard for me. You know, I'd always have to go through somebody else for an interpreter, and it was, you know, I realised that the whole lump of what I do is missing, and so it's the oral part of my work is, which you don't see when you witness the work, is very important. You know, for me, it's that's really the work's almost like a waste product from that kind of interaction or that journey I've had.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of describing it, as a waste product from a waste product from a conversation, because it seems to me that so many of your works have this incredible generosity about them, and not generosity in terms of a gift, but a generosity of spirit in terms of these aren't works that are ending, they're not a full stop, they're a comma. So it's as if they're kind of initiating another conversation. So you've got the encounter that you come across that, from what you're saying, happens through your own insatiable curiosity. So you find something out, you follow it through, but then you invite everyone who then encounters the work to have a conversation with it. So there's almost a continuous practice or a continuous temporality to the artwork.
I mean, when I had to come up with the title for my exhibition at the Icon, I called it Never Endings, plural, because I just felt that there was all these kind of unfinished businesses going on, you know, that one thing leads to another, and you make a work which is not a full stop, it's just a kind of, as you say, a comma, it's a, you know, pause for breath, and then, you know, I've got such a grasshopper mind, attention deficit disorder most probably, but, you know, that I'm always thinking about the next, you know, thing, or, and sometimes it's like, you know, having an exhibition is like a pausing the breath, that you know, there's these little concretions that go on which are the work, and then, you know, there's so many different threads that lead off to other places. You know, I think that's mostly why I've worked in so many different mediums, just because I, you know, I'm endlessly curious about stuff.
And what's really particularly interesting, I think, for me with Chomsky in Abstract, which is a 42-minute film, is that the way the film is constructed, we know that it's a conversation. And I think a conversation rather than an interview, because an interview sort of, I don't know, it assumes that someone is asking and someone else is answering. It's a conversation, yet we don't know what you're saying. And I kept on thinking when I first saw that work that it's as if you're inhabiting the spaces between listening and telling, and not just in this work, but in the rest of the work. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how you came to really develop that conversation with Chomsky, because I understand you invited him first to go over to the Shah Jar Biennial, is that right, as your contribution?
Yes, I've you know, the Biennale, which I was asked to be in, which took place about a year ago, the theme of it was still life, art, the environment, and the politics of change.
Which
and
is I such think, a paradox.
Yeah, and it's like a paradox being located in that particular country, which has, you know, got a huge fossil fuel economy. And I don't know, I was very conflicted about being in this Biennale and about what I could possibly do that was, you know, could engage with that, you know, issue. And I just thought I'd do something. I showed a couple of pieces I'd already made that, you know, like a burnt forest piece. But then I really wanted to do something more head-on, something more confrontational, I suppose, because I was feeling so sort of worried about things that are happening in the world at the moment. And I had, you know, seen Chomsky speak in 92, I think it was. Okay. And then more recently, you know, in the Bush era, you know, his voice seemed to be much increasingly more important.
It's as if he's cutting through disinformation in some way.
Yes, because there's so much stuff that, you know, he just seems very clear, and even if you don't agree with what he says, you know, there's an incredible bravery and clarity about an uncompromising, you know, sort of truth to materials, as it were, in terms of what he says. I really was burning with a desire to ask him questions. You know, I thought, well, he's, you know, he's getting on a bit, he's 79, you know, he's not going to be around forever, and, you know, I don't know, it's one of those. So I really wanted to hear him, you know, have a conversation about, you know, the possible end of the world vis-a-vis environmental disaster. He talked about a lot of other, you know, perhaps a nuclear meltdown or other, you know, sort of possible apocalypses. And I just felt that he never really talked about that. And so, so I, although he couldn't come, he wasn't travelling to do his an illness in the family. I asked if he could go and talk to him there. He's at MIT in Boston, and I didn't expect him to say yes,
because just the act of inviting Chomsky, I mean, it's like inviting, I don't know.
I don't know. Impossible to think.
Well,
I just thought of the idea of him going to the Middle East, being in this particular place when he's talked a lot about the Middle East, would be, you know, quite a, you know, I just thought Chomsky should be there, you know, as part of this. But, you know, so in the end, that couldn't happen. So therefore, it fell to me perhaps to go and talk to him, and I wasn't going to be the person in conversation with him before. It was going to be some, I'm not exactly sure who, but somebody a lot more articulate and politically astute than I was. But anyway, so when I had this very brief, you know, I was given 45 minutes to talk to Chomsky.
That just sounds terrifying. So you have to very think small, about what you're going
you know,
to
and
say.
I thought, oh, what a tiny window of time, you know, and I was hoping I'd have all afternoon. And so then I had to think very hard about what questions I was going to ask, and they became almost too important. You know, it became too, I don't know, having this very small, you know, window of time. In the end, he gave me an hour. You know, his secretary kept coming in and interrupting the interview, saying, your time's up, and he just carried on. He didn't even bat an eyelid, but you could hear her voice, and so we had to cut some of that out. Perhaps I should have kept that in. That was, and then my questions seemed to melt away. You know, I didn't.
Okay.
But I loved the fact he was, you know, when I was having this very, looking him in the eyes all the time and completely nervous and riveted by what he was saying, it seemed really important. But I loved him sort of trying to fathom what it was.
It's as if
I was
you
asking.
Can see his mind in progress, thinking through how.
And that's what
was
I was getting when I was there. You know that I was, you know, all of my voice was droning on. And then I thought when it came to editing the film, I didn't really want that me in it. You know, I just thought, well, but I didn't want to lose this kind of this silent, you know, space where he's listening and trying to think. You know what? How he could respond, and then he responds, and so that's where the still life came in. I think it was almost like this idea of the, you know, allowing him that. You know, you when you hear eminent people speak, you're only seeing them speak. You're not necessarily, you know, watching them, just listening and sort of thinking.
And it becomes this real attention to detail this time of someone's pattern of thought or the ways in which it becomes a portrait. And it seems really important that this work sits within a wider series titled Abstract, and you described it as being forensic forays into the minutiae of iconic thinkers, which is a kind of really, really wonderful phrase, I think. And so other works in this series are Marks Made by Freud Subconsciously, which is a photograph of the creases made by Freud on his leather seat, or there's Einstein's Abstracts, or Bronte and Abstracts, which are these amazing nibs of a quill or nibs of a pen that are honed in such detail that what they are disappears. And I think for me that comes back to this importance of the how as well as the what in your work. So, I mean, this sense of picking up these minutiae of details, these things that don't matter. But I think, particularly in this series, there is this attention to detail.
Well, it's also almost like the unconscious of these famous places, you know, the unconscious of the monument almost, you know, it's the Chomsky, you know, allowing yourself time to look at him thinking, you know, somehow seemed to be not what, you know, concentrating not only what comes out of his mouth, but what doesn't come out of his mouth.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like the inverse or like taking an image of Emily Bronte's the nib of her quill pen in an electron microscope, so you can see the worn down beak of this, you know, natural object that she's been scribbling away.
Yeah.
You know, the friction that, and this is something she's created. You know, she's worn down that nib, but it's not really what she's known for. It's this piece of abrasion, so it's almost like or pinhole made by Charlotte, you know, you know, magnifying that and making that into
that's from the pin cushion.
Yeah, so it's like focusing on one little pinhole, which she's done completely unconsciously. She's not, you know, the little acts of friction that they made, you know, that somehow you could tell more about them through those than you can necessarily through their writing.
Because it's as if what you're showing, I think a very simplistic way of describing it is evidence of thought or evidence of activity, but I don't think it is just evidence, because evidence almost implies some kind of empiricism or some kind of factual content. I think what I really, really love about your work is that you're presenting these things, and I can't think of a word better than a thing, but it seems to do the job, these things that are that have experienced encounters that we then, and we including you as the artist, but then kind of us as people looking at the artwork, project our own ideas.
Well, I think, you know, that the pinhole, for example, I mean, remember years ago, I was, I think it was some, at the other Tate, I was on a panel about intention in making art, you know, yeah. It's all about intention, what's your intention, you know, and I found that idea really terrifying, you know, and I was trying to describe intention for myself, you know, about, I think I described it as sort of an Eastern saying about a hole. You know, if there's a hole in a material, you describe the hole by what the material is. You know, like if it's a marble hole or a wooden hole, it's not, the hole's not made of wood or the or marble, but it's a space around the hole is what defines it, because you can't quantify what the hole is, because it's nothing. You know, and somehow as yourself, you never see yourself except in the mirror. You know, you somehow, it's all to do with the stuff around you and how that reacts, you know, you, or you react to it, and somehow the intention sort of falls away, you know, but somehow can only be described by this other, the opposite somehow. And I don't know, it's very hard to describe. I've just been in Lima, and I gave a guided tour of this museum show in Lima, and somebody in the audience said, "What's the punctum?" The punctum of the work. And I thought, punctum? I said, "Don't do punctums." And what's the point, you know? And I just thought, you know, it's not pointless, but somehow that's not the point.
But it really makes me think of that amazing thing that that John Cage said, as he advised people to pay attention to the spaces between words, because it's a process that's energizing and more exciting. And I think that it's as if you're pointing to the stuff around the thing, and we never know what the thing is. And if we did, if we could place it within language, it would disappear in some way.
And I think the idea of, you know, being a visual artist, and okay, I mean, a lot of my work alludes to words and absence of words, perhaps, but, you know, I like that, you know, things with the Brontes, for example, because they're known for their words, but the idea of giving them images, or there being an imagery that can be associated with them that's not, you know, the same as their literature. And, you know, it's quite raw and primitive in some kind of way. You know, people don't think of that about the Brontes. But I think, I suppose, you know, my work's not about famous people or famous landmarks or whatever. I just choose those things because they stand in for...
They stand in for a kind of, not a collective consciousness, but a kind of a collective act of perception, perhaps.
Yes, I think, you know, we nominate people to represent certain... you know, things like Freud or Chomsky or, Bronte's romanticism, or, you know, there's, we kind of, these people are very well visited and very legendary because for a good reason, you know, but it's almost like somehow they're just a catalyst for something, you know, that's much more subterranean.
But of course it's not just people as well, you're kind of looking to language as a structure too, so... There's the amazing piece of work you made in 1992, which is Words That Define Gravity. which is just, I think, such an amazing work, where there's kind of text that appears as if it's handwriting, something very personal, yet it's not. It's a definition of gravity.
It was the definition of gravity made in lead, and it was my handwriting, but I'd cast all these words. You know, the dictionary definition of gravity has got a couple of meanings, you know, one the gravitational pull, but another one which is gravitas, you know, grave things, and this idea of taking this definition and throwing it off the White Cliffs of Dover and having real gravity make it completely illegible, you know, so there's little tangled lumps of lead you couldn't read afterwards, which I quite like the idea of real gravity doing away with man's sort of definition of it. And so it felt like a very... And also, I got terrible vertigo, you know, so the idea of standing on top of the White Cliffs of Dover was a rope around me, was and two people on the end of it. Not in the photograph, you know, cleverly hidden. But, you know, like, you know, for me, it was a real physical act of not destroying language, but it's about the tussle we have with, you know, everything that's man-made, you know, versus nature, you know, somehow. That,
And also placing this language in between spaces, because I think quite often your work is engaging in a conversation with gravity, but not in terms of gravity being this, again, this empirical fact that we know gravity exists and it makes things fall down. But it's almost as if you're slowing down gravity and drawing attention to its speed and its pace by suspending objects.
I mean, it's, you know, obviously nothing gets really suspended. You know, we're all, know, the reason that things hang towards the Earth, as it were, rather than float around, is to do with this gravitational pull. This is why the idea of sending a meteorite back into space really appealed to me, because it really would defy gravity, you know, would not be bound by this rule of you know, this idea of a star that's fallen, pulled in by the Earth's gravity, gets let free again.
And that these various things that keep on coming back in your work are meteorites. You seem to be quite a fan of meteorites.
Oh, yes. No, I suppose it was another of those irrational fears, you know, that you have, that, you know, you're going, the white, you know, the world's going to be sort of obliterated by a meteor. You know, this is before global warming and nuclear, you know, destruction fixated itself in my brain. but I do love this idea that, you know, things are, you know, meteors, you know, hundreds of thousands of meteorites have fell on the Earth, but we very, very few people have seemed to have been hit by one. You know, I mean, I think there was a photograph of a woman in, I think it was in Alabama, who'd been hit, had a big bruise on her leg from a meteor that fell through her living room, bounced off a piece of furniture and hit her leg. But, but you know, this is one of the few recorded. And I just thought, well, how come is it? You know, these little things are entering the atmosphere all the time and landing, but nobody's getting kind of wiped out. So I don't know. It's very reassuring somehow that. I don't know. And then I looked at the moon, you know.
Yes.
The moon is covered in craters. And I thought, well, how come that's covered in craters and we're not? I mean, I don't know, all that sort of stuff. But I don't know, I like the idea of this, you know, returning something, you know, that's been forced into our orbit, you know, that we...
And you also bought meteorites from eBay. Which seems completely nuts that you buy meteorites.
Well, before eBay, I used to buy them from geological suppliers. Okay. But in the end, I'm buying them off geological suppliers through eBay because they're just doing it online, you know. But you know, and more recently, I've been more interested in buying moon rock.
Okay. Which I don't know if it's less or more bizarre.
Becoming more lunatic as I get older. I love this idea that, you know, that. You know, that you could buy a piece of the moon. Mm-mm. And the first piece of the moon I bought, I looked at it through a microscope, and actually you could almost see craters in it. You know, it looked just like the surface of the moon. It just felt like you'd bought a little microcosm of the moon. And it just seemed fascinating to me that you could actually buy a piece of Mars or a piece of the moon. And that this, you know, it's just... And in fact, I was asked to be in an expo in Japan. They did a British pavilion in the expo, an art, you know, garden. And then was it 1970, I think, was the first Japanese expo, and they men had just been to the moon, and they'd had a little tiny piece of moon rock on display at this expo, and people had queued around the block to see this, you know, to see this piece of moon rock. And so I, for my piece at the expo, I bought a piece of moon rock and threw it in the garden and let it disappear, because it's just, you know, and then I put a sign saying that in the garden that there's been a moon landing, and that